Mr. Chairman, our guests, ladies, gentlemen, and Rotarians, it's my great pleasure to be able to introduce to you our next speaker, our guest speaker, and I'm sure you'll enjoy him, Lyn Bedell, known really as the last true Australian explorer. He is well known as a surveyor. Lyn is also an author. He was born in West Pennant Hills in New South Wales in 1923. Hope you don't mind that, Lyn. And even at the age of 12, he became interested in surveying under the guidance of his surveyor scoutmaster. Before long, after having been involved in a military mapping program, he joined the Australian Army Survey Corps, serving in New Guinea until 1945. Lyn remained in the Army and joined the CSIRO, Scientific Expedition, which carried out astronomical observations in our Northern Territory. Next, he carried out early atomic surveys for what later became the Woomera Rocket Range, and later discovered the test sites for the Emu and Maralinga sites. Lyn has had a lifetime association in that area as a civilian until his retirement recently in 1988. After 41 years of continual camping, surveying, exploring and road making, opening up 2.5 million square kilometres of the Great Sandy, the Gibson and the Great Victorian Deserts. In the same year, Lyn was awarded the British Empire Medal for his part in building the famous Gun Barrel Highway. Some of you may have been along that, which is a 1,500 kilometre road link east-west across the centre of Australia. In 1987, he was created a Fellow of the Institute of Engineer and Mining Surveyors, and in the same year, the Mount Palomar Astronomical Observatory in California named a newly discovered asteroid planet in his name. Well, you'd be the only one of those in the hall then. In 1988, he was awarded the Medal of the Order of Australia. In the following year, he received an Advanced Australia Award from the Governor of South Australia. Lyn and his wife, Anne, have three children, Connie Sue, Gary and Jackie. Will you please listen to Lyn Bedell?
Oh, thank you. Wonder how Australia got along without me. I was standing around a campfire 30 years ago on a freezing July night out in the desert, and I carefully asked the fellow alongside me, was there anything wrong? Was something troubling him? And he said, no, why should you think that? And I said, oh, well, it's just that you haven't said anything to anyone since February. he said, well, you haven't got to say anything, have you? And I said, oh, no, I don't suppose so, no. And I left it at that until October. And then I said to him, are you sure there's nothing wrong? And he said, you're always picking on me. So that happened 8 years after we drove up on the old dirt Stuart Highway to Alice Springs with our little newly formed, that I called it, the Gun Barrel Road Construction Party. We were on our way to make a network of roads 4,000 miles. I'll talk about miles and gallons because I don't know what they are in kilopascals. And this is for the purpose of opening up over a million square miles of central and western Australia, which hadn't been touched by anybody since the world began. A couple of explorers in the last century had been out through those areas, but nobody had been there before or since, and it was left to me to go up and open this. But we came to an obstruction on the Stuart Highway. It was an enormous truck, about a 40-ton truck, bogged in the very middle of the road, in a thick mulga scrub thicket where nobody could drive around them, And we just happened to have a bulldozer with us, and a grader, and three-ton trucks. So we joined all these together and pulled this 40-ton truck out of the bog and parked it neatly alongside the road on a rocky outcrop. And then we bulldozed, there was nobody about, of course, and we bulldozed a lot of dirt in and graded it over and rolled it and carried on our way, leaving behind about 300 yards of the best piece of Stuart Highway all the way from Adelaide to Alice Springs. I often wondered what happened later. I found out what happened later. The driver, when he got the truck bogged down to its mudguards, he thought, I'm not going to stay with this job. So he went into the next sheep station. He hitched onto the Oodnadatta train, went down to Adelaide, went into his boss and said, I'm quitting. And the boss said, where's the truck? And he said, oh, you'll find it on the Stuart Highway. I often wondered what the boss thought when he went up and found the truck neatly parked on the high and dry alongside the best piece of road on the whole of the way. But we were on our way. The origins of all this started 44 years ago when I was casually asked if I would go and start a rocket range. They said, would you go and start a rocket range? And I said, yes, I couldn't think of anything better. I'd always wanted to start a rocket range, ever since I was four. And I said, what do you need? And they said, we need a big area. And I said, oh, I know where there's a million square miles of nothing, so that'll be good. And I said, when do you want this rocket range? And they said, straight away, right now. I said, oh, good, I won't even have to wait. And then I said, where do you want it? And they said, we don't know that. I said, oh, well, I'll find somewhere, I'm sure. And so I went over to South Australia to start off this project on their advice, saying that they had found that there's a man who'd come over from UK by the name of General Sir John Evatts as a forerunner sent by Sir Winston Churchill to initiate such a project, a worldwide rocket range to test British missiles. He was in Adelaide, and they told me what he looked like, and I said, well, that's handy, I'll go and find him. Well, the description they gave me didn't give me any doubt that I would find him. He was 8 feet high and 7 inches diameter. And I thought, well, that pins it down. And So, walking along, I got within 300 yards of him in North Terrace in Adelaide, and I saw him straight away. And I went over to him and I tapped him on the knee, and I said, look, I've come to start a rocket range. And he said, by Jove, that's good. And I said, well, that's got rid of that formality. What do you want? He said, well, we do need a big area. And I told him where I knew was a good big area. And we looked at a map of Australia, and 100 miles the other side of Port Augusta seemed about as far back across Australia as we could get with any sort of safety. That would leave 1,500 miles of country northwest to a point in the middle of the 80-mile beach between Broome and Port Hedland on the Indian Ocean, because the rockets, when they were fired from this site, were required to go over land as far as they could before going over water. In that way, we could place instrumentation on the mainland, track the behaviour of the rockets, and then we could modify them and make them fly under other conditions but those of a testing range. And so I drove up to this general area at the other side of Port Augusta with a Jeep and a 3-ton truck to start the project. At that time, I thought it was going to last a fortnight. The only rockets I'd ever heard of were ones you put the sticks in a milk bottle and light the fuses. And when they go off, you think, oh, that's pretty, and the sparks and everything, everyone would go away. But I didn't have any idea that it was going to occupy the entire rest of my working life for the next 40-odd years. And when I got to the general area where Woomera is now, a lot of you would have been to Woomera or may have been through, I had the feeling, the same as you might have if you had have been there, that I wasn't hemmed in. I discovered very quickly I could see a bull ant for 10 miles, unless he was lying down. And I thought, now, what a perfect area to start a rocket range. what a perfect area to start anything. There was nothing I could spoil to the horizon. So I settled down and started off the project. And the very first thing I did, I selected a mountain near my camp, which was 9 inches higher than the rest of the plains. And after climbing up on top of this, I didn't even have to use oxygen. And when I got up there, I found that I could see a lot more of nothing from up there than what I could at my camp. So that's where I decided to start the project. And I put in a survey mark and I spent a whole week up there reading angles onto stars, calculations for giving me a latitude and longitude origin from which I could start the whole project. And everything we did at Woomera from there on, Maralinga, Emu and everything else, was all related to this one pinpoint on the surface of the Earth. Nobody really knows that, but that, and it doesn't matter anyway, but that's what it is. And of course, when you start a firing range of any sort, a rifle range or a bow and arrow or anything else, you've got to start, arrive at a center line along which you should be shooting. And the only way I could do that was to choose a point in the middle of the 80-mile beach, 1,500 miles away, and I worked out a bearing across Australia, which would become the center line of fire for the rockets. Now, that line I decided on because it was the only line in Australia, or almost the world, that you could get 1,500 miles of country where there was nothing in the way whatsoever. You come to think of 1,500 miles anywhere in the world, you'll be coming over villages and pipelines and roads and railway lines and townships and everything, cattle stations. But there was this one corridor across Australia which was devoid of anything at all. A little bit to one side, I would have been hitting Broome and Darwin. A little bit to the other side, I'd be hitting Port Hedland and Geraldton and those sort of places. But it was this one corridor. So I decided on that's where the centre line was going to be. And when I worked out the bearing across Australia that we were going to arrange all the instrumentation to track the rockets, I found that centre line, although I didn't know it at the time, was going to govern the whole of the future of Central and Western Australia forever. Anything that ever takes place in the whole of that million square miles of Central Australia was going to be governed by that centre line of fire, because that's the centre line about which I was to open up later on with a network of 4,000 miles of access roads so we could get out there and place instrumentation, carrying out special surveys for satellite tracking stations, impact areas, target areas, and all that was required. Every now and then, I used to go into the local railway siding to collect the latest urgent messages which would be telegraphed up to me along the Trans-Australian Railway line, telling me the latest requirements for this range. However urgent they were, every month I used to pick them up. And the first one said, we must have a site for an airstrip. Visiting scientists have to come to this area. They've got to come quickly, see what they're in for, go away quickly and prepare for the conditions. Their time's valuable and they must have an airstrip. And I thought, that's a bit elaborate for one nice fireworks display. So I picked out a site for a runway with the least amount of earthworks. It was not very hard. And I was doing a contour survey map of this whole area so we could plan what we were going to do on paper first. And there were two contours on the map, so from my own contour survey, I found out where I could put a runway. And if anyone's ever been to Woomera and landed there, that's the aerodrome they will land on. It became the airport for Woomera forever. Next month went by, they said, now we must have a site for a township. People have got to have somewhere to live while they're doing these experiments, and we got to have a town. And I thought, a town? I was going to put up a tent fly at the most to keep the sun off. But I thought, well, all right, a township. So, remote from the approach funnel going into the aerodrome, I picked out a site which would be nice for a village and did a survey there, and that's where the Woomera Township is today. And the next month they said, we're sending you up a 10,000-gallon water tank. And I thought, that's a handy thing to have. I didn't know what I was going to put in it, but I thought it'd be handy for having somewhere to jump into to keep out of the dust storms. All I could see to the horizon was salt bushes and gibbers. And so that was the very signal and the very day that I slowly was getting the idea that this was going to be a bit bigger project than I first imagined. This was going to be something far bigger than I first thought. And so after 6 months, during which time I had the place to myself, people started to come across the horizon with bulldozers and graders to build the airfield. And it was getting too crowded. I showed them the line of pegs that I'd put in, a centre line across the salt bush, and they started to construct the airfield. And it was too crowded. There were 11 people there then, and I couldn't get to know everybody. I used to know everybody there. And so I left them with it and went on the country over which the rockets would be passing to a distance of 300 miles up the centre line that I had calculated, carrying out surveys and astronomical observations to draw maps on the country for the first 300 miles of the line of flight, which is a very critical distance in rocket flight. They've got to know how it's going, where the first stages is going, the trajectory and all about it, they've got to be able to monitor it. Doppler arrays and kinetiotolites and radar trackers and all the rest, and that's got to be clustered with a massive instrumentation. So it was unmapped country, except school atlases. There was no maps drawn of it, so we had to have a series of maps so we could plan the instrumentation. So I spent 2 years up there on my own, mostly by myself, because I could never find anyone to come with me. I always used to want to stop every 4 days and have something to eat. And I was doing a series of star observations long, long before satellite navigation and satellites and everything else. The only way I could find exactly where I was on the Earth was star observations and calculations. And I was out there mending 6 flat tires a day, working 100 miles west of the Cooper Pedy opal fields in this thick, solid mulga scrub that nobody had ever had occasion to go into before. The country west of the Stuart Highway is made up of solid mulga scrub, sand hills, which go on for the next 1,000 miles. Of course, I didn't know that at that stage, but I knew that it was pretty tiger country. And I spent that time pushing through this country doing astrofixes. And I had eating bully beef out of a tin with a coal chisel. I didn't have any water to waste washing up. And one stage there, I couldn't even move through the scrub to even change a flat tire. It was so thick. And in the middle of all this, they decided to force me to carry a transmitter with me. They said, you're out there for months and months at a time. Nobody knows where you are. You could be landed underneath a Jeep, slipped off a jack, and pinned down. We wouldn't know. Be a waste of a Jeep. They said, if only we could know where you are. So they put a little transmitter in the Jeep. And in 2 years' time, I got a message on that. And I thought, what a handy thing. If I hadn't have had this, I wouldn't have got this message. And it was to order me back to headquarters immediately, come straight to Salisbury as fast as I could, treating it with the utmost urgency. And I thought, heavens, what have I done? I haven't upset anyone. I haven't seen anyone. So I threw my swag into the Jeep and I headed off through the sandhills. It took me a week to get back as far as the Stuart Highway, which was the nearest track or road or anything to where I was, pushing through sandhills and scrub. When I finally got to Adelaide, they locked me up in a little tiny office and 6 people were standing there glaring at me. They drew the blinds and soldered the keyholes over these 6 people. The chief security officer started off the conversation in the most friendly way I'd heard for a long time, merely because I hadn't heard anyone for a long time. He said, what we're going to tell you now is known to these 6 people in this room and nobody else. And if it gets outside this room, it'll be one of us and we'll find him and it'll be a 9 years jail sentence. And I thought, well, whatever you're going to tell me, I might even keep it to myself. The chief scientist for the whole project carried on then and he said, now what we're going to tell you is that we're going to explode an atomic bomb in Australia. and we want you to pick out a site. So that all I thought was something important. I'd come all that way. And it was to pick out a site for the first atom bomb that was ever going to be exploded on the mainland of Australia. So straight away, when they ask you to pick out a site for an atom bomb, what do you think about it? Somewhere fairly well out of the way. So I went along the centre line of my rocket range, and I thought, now, I had been working out there for years in most remote country, and I was the most remote person in Australia at the time out there. I thought, if I go 100 miles further out into the scrub, I'd be getting really well out of the way. And that's where I headed for. And I spent 5 months searching an area of 30,000 square miles in a general area that we needed to have this site, not close to the centre line, the fictitious centre line across Australia, because any future instrumentation might be contaminated. So I went out to this, and I finally found, purely by accident, a clay pan on the other side of a sandhill, and I went over this sandhill, and there was this clay pan, a mile long, half a mile wide. One glance told me that you could land any weight aircraft we had at the time without any preparation, a perfect natural runway in the wilderness. I called this my base, and I searched out in all directions in a radius of about 100 miles from this, trying to find an area free of sandhills and mulga scrub. An atomic bomb site or any other site would mean somewhere where you'd be able to move about without having to climb up over sandhills and push through thick scrub. You'd need plenty of room to put instrumentation to record the results, the bomb itself, a place where we could put a tent camp for people to live in, and you certainly wouldn't have want solid mulga scrub and sandhills. So one of the directions, 40 miles away, I did find an area where the sandhills diminished and disappeared, the mulga scrub thinned out to open saltbush paddocks, and in between were little clumps of mulga, and I thought, this is a perfect site for a bomb. So I picked a spot, the best spot in the middle of it, and I did a very careful astrophix, radioed that down to the chief security officer, and it took me 3 days to work out that astrophix, and 5 days to work out the code that they'd given me. They'd given me a great big thick book, and anything that went over the air from there on had to be converted into the most complicated code, owing to the nature of the security surrounding this thing. And so they said, now, a party has come over from England now on their way to the Montebello Islands, led by the most brilliant atomic scientist in the world at the time, a man by the name of Sir William Penny. He was Dr. Penny at the time. He is now Lord Penny in London. This man had a genius of a mathematical brain on a level with Albert Einstein. And he was the director of the whole concern, director of the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment in UK. And he was going to come to my camp, stop with me for 2 weeks while I entertained him and showed him my bomb site for Australia. And so he was going to bring with him 12 of the United Kingdom Ministry of Supply, Ministry of Aviation, leaders in the whole of the British Empire in their own field of work. They were going to descend on me while I showed them this bomb site. And I thought, now they'll be able to land on the clay pan all right, but they won't know where it is. And I have to tell them where, so I gave them the latitude and longitude. And they said, we're sending out two aeroplanes, one full of the official party and the other one full of spoons and forks. I was going to order in another 12 coal chisels. I didn't have enough cutlery to start with. And they thought that a few amenities, which they might have been used to in UK, they wouldn't have got at my camp, which was right, because they wouldn't have got anything at all. So they were going to send two aeroplanes. And I said, well, now, they'll be able to land on the clay pan all right, but I'll have to set out a line of Land Rovers. Firstly, I had to get some Land Rovers up so they could drive down to the bomb site. They'd land on the clay pan, but they couldn't get the 50 miles through the scrub. So I ordered 8 brand new Land Rovers to be driven up to Coober Pedy. My plan was to make a new set of wheel tracks all the way back to Coober Pedy, meet the Land Rovers and guide them out to my clay pan. In that way, I'd have all these Land Rovers on the spot like an instant Hertz rent-a-car, so they could come and drive themselves down to the spot. and all these drivers were coming out through the scrub, and one of them said, "What are you going to do with all these Land Rovers now you've got them? You've been out here for half a year and you suddenly say you'd rather like 8 Land Rovers and they give them to you. What are you going to do with them?" And I couldn't tell him. I was thinking of the 9 years in jail. All I could think of saying in a hurry was, "Well, it'll save me mending flat tyres. I won't have to mend a flat tyre for a long time." Ever since then, nobody came near me. Wherever I went, they'd back away. They were sure that I'd been too long in the bush. And so when we finally got to the site, I arranged for a Bristol freighter to come and take all the drivers away. And, of course, the Bristol freighter, unfortunately, had to be flown by somebody. And the location of this site was so top secret, nobody was allowed to know. But they recognised that, and they found an Air Commodore who had a very good rank and high enough to be grudgingly let in on the secret. He was a good pilot also. In 1918, he still had his wings, but they're all moth-eaten. They said, "It's all right there because we do have a visiting Air Vice Marshal to come as a co-pilot." I thought, "Oh, that's all right then." He's still got a revolver that he used to shoot the Germans down out of his cockpit. And he was a good pilot too, and he's been behind a desk since 1918. So the poor little group captain was sent along to wash up for them. And they were flying along, and I said, "Well, now, they mightn't have very good navigation." So we made a huge mulga wood fire, put a couple of stake rubber tyres on the top of it. Terrible for pollution, but I thought, "Well, now the burning rubber would billow up into the sky in a pencil of smoke which can be seen from 100 miles in that country." And so the morning they were due to come, we were all looking in the direction of Woomera, and suddenly somebody saw the plane coming from the opposite direction. We thought, "Oh, that's funny." And we found out what happened. They were on their way out, and they'd missed us by 80 miles on the south, and they just decided to fly onto Fremantle and refuel and have another go. But just as they'd made up their mind to do that, the group captain, acting as navigator, looked out of the side and he saw this pencil of smoke on the horizon. And he thought, "I wonder if that's them signalling." So he tapped the Air Commodore, and that meant he had to turn the aeroplane around somehow. It was a big thing, and he had a book put out by the Bristol people on it, and they said, "Turn the wheel and pull back and push that pedal down. It should go around." So he thought, "Oh, I'll try that." And he did, and it worked. I said, "Keep back at the same time, otherwise it does that." And he said, "Oh, I'll try it." It worked, and he came over and finally saw the clay pan, us on the clay pan, and he circled around to come in for a landing. One of the wheels did anyway, and when I saw that wheel, the angle that wheel was making with the runway, nobody had ever, of course, landed on this clay pan ever since it was created. And I didn't watch the touchdown because touchdown wasn't going to describe this landing. And so when he finally, it didn't stay there long, the other one landed then, and then the other one, and the whole thing stopped a mile away just before it went into the sandhills. We'd made tests with Bristol before I did go out for this sort of thing, and I found that they can land and come to a stop in 176 yards. But he took the mile and taxied back across the clay pan and jumped out all smiles and asked me what I thought of the landing. And I didn't know which one he was talking about. I said, they're all right. And his mouth took on a 8:20 shape. And I said, "Oh, no, don't look sad. You just come to think of what you've done. You can imagine this clay pan has never been seen by a white person since the world began. And now on this historic morning, you have made 8 aeroplane landings on it." So we finally had to convince the fellas to jump onto it. And all these drivers, we had sticks and pushed them in, slammed the door quickly before they could escape. And they took off and flew away in the general direction of Woomera. And I was left in the desert with 8 brand new Land Rovers and nobody else, black or white, for hundreds and hundreds of miles in any direction. And so I used to use this one on Monday and that one on Tuesday, and I never knew what to do with the 8th one. And so finally, after 2 weeks, I got this message to say that this official party is coming with these two aeroplanes. And so I thought the night before they were due to come, I looked down at myself for the first time in half a year, and I thought, I do look scruffy. I absolutely look scruffy. I had a shirt with which was very little of it left. There was no sleeves in it, and it was just, but there was a button. And I thought, now that's handy, because in April, I remember I saw a buttonhole. So I thought, if I put those together, that'll have the effect of keeping off the westerlies. When I'm talking to these people, I'll make sure I'm always facing east. The pair of shorts, I couldn't do much about. They were broken in one place when you're driving over rough country all the time. I couldn't do much about that. And I had a pair of hobnailed boots on, only tied up to two holes with kangaroo sinew laces, because every July and September I used to have to take them off in a hurry to empty out centipedes. It rained twice a year, and every time it had rained, centipedes would find my funnel top boots and climb in. I used to tie them up to three holes for special occasions. When the Duke of Edinburgh came to Woomera, that was a three-hole job. And so I thought a pair of socks could make this whole thing look a little neater. And I didn't have any socks, of course, so I found a pullover in some rags that I clean the engine, grease off the engine before you work on it. And those sleeves, perfect. So I chopped them off with my axe, and I thought, these have got an added advantage to any other sock I'd ever seen. I can put them on without even taking my boots off. So so I pulled them up my leg and bent the tops over with a pair of pliers. They're all stiff. And I had to tie them under my boot with a piece of kangaroo sinew, because the boots kept pushing them up and giving it away. Eventually, I was all dressed for this official party, so I lay down in my swag on the clay pan, fully dressed. 4 o'clock the next morning, the drone of these two aeroplanes came, spot on target, perfect navigation, because they decided that Sir William Penny was the most valuable person in the world as far as atomic bombs were concerned, and they couldn't rely on the Air Vice Marshal to fly him. So they found some good pilots, a flight sergeant and a Lance Corporal, who were very good pilots. And they had to be reluctantly let in on the secret, because Sir William's face was synonymous with atom bombs in front pages all over the world in newspapers, so they couldn't hide it from them. So they were flying, and they came perfect navigation, came in for beautiful landings. I switched on all the headlights of the Land Rovers. I had it placed along the clay pan as a guide. And they came over, and the first person to get out of the aeroplane was the chief scientist, followed on his heels by this great genius of mathematics, Sir William Penny. And you'd expect there to be a greeting, good morning, how are you, or how's things, or something like that. There was nobody else. One person walking across the clay pan to meet them, and these people getting out of the aeroplane, dead of night out in the desert. But all the chief scientist said was, take those socks off, I can't concentrate. I thought, well, they were stifling me, so I pulled them off over my boots and threw them back in the rags, and I feel better already. And the first thing that Sir William Penny ever said to me was, would you do that again? I didn't catch that. He said, I've never seen anybody do that in Shaftesbury Avenue without first removing their shoes. I said, oh, these are special Australian socks, and I showed him the loops, and he was writing it all down. He says, they'll never believe me back in Aldermaston. And so they paired themselves off into the Land Rovers the next morning when the sun came up, and we set off for the bomb site. And we got 10 miles the first day. That's how long it took me to walk back over every sandhill and bring their Land Rovers across one at a time. They'd never driven anywhere rougher than Piccadilly Circus. And before we left the edge of the clay pan, I stopped to let them see the little pebbles around the edge of the clay pan, the formations. And one of them said, what made that footprint in the wet sand, in the wet, once wet clay? And I said, oh, that's an emu's foot. When a bit of a shower came here once, an emu's foot put his foot on the soft mud and it left an imprint. That's an emu's foot. So we started to call this clay pan the clay pan with the emu's footmark on it. Gradually that just became the emu clay pan. And the following year when the bombs did go off, it went around the world on the front page of every newspaper, Emu Field Atomic Test Successful, and that's where the name Emu came from, Emu Bombs, and that was the first in Australia. And so we stopped at one little clay pan the size of this, and one of the scientists said, I've noticed something in common with these clay pans. I've noticed that when they crack, when they dry after the little shower and the hot sun dries them out, the surface cracks up. But I've always noticed they crack in pentagons. And I said, they've got to crack in pentagons. Oh, yes, they must do that. And they said, why is that? And I thought, well, now, when these sort of people ask you a question, you've got to answer them straight away. They used to say to me, look here, when do these flies go? And I said, 18th of April. And they'd write that down. They're very precise sort of people. So anyway, they had asked me why they do crack in pentagons, and I said, well, I had to answer them. I said, it's all tied up with the lateral cohesion acting on the surface tension of the colloidal suspension of molecules of laterite. And I said, oh, I see. I thought, thank heavens I don't. And they formed their own atomic theory how clay pans have got to crack into pentagons. And just then I was horrified. I looked down at my foot and there was an octagon right in front of me. I stood over it and my boots just covered it nicely. I couldn't move for half an hour until they got back into their Land Rovers. And then we picked out a site. We showed them the site where the bomb was to go off, and that is where the first bomb went off in Australia. And the following year, 400 people descended on me on the clay pan, bringing in all these people to actually build the atomic site. A 100-foot steel tower with great big steel girders. We're going to winch the bomb up to the top. Are we getting time? Winch the bomb up to the top of the tower. And we were going to explode at 100 feet off the ground, this atom bomb. And I had to make a new road from the clay pan all the way to the Stuart Highway, because we had to bring the atom bomb itself, the casing of it, up by road, and all the instrumentation that we needed that we couldn't carry on aeroplanes, 52-ton Centurion tank and all the rest of it. And finally, we had the site all ready. The job of laying out the instrumentation fell to me. That took me a year to lay out thousands and thousands of instruments arrayed around it to record the results. And the morning that they were due to come, we were standing. Some of us had some interesting little things to do apart from a normal work. I had to go to the foot of the tower and join up two wires. I wasn't sure what they were going to do, so I left my Land Rover half an inch away from me, idling, idling over at 500,000 revs, and joined up the wires. And while I was standing there, I looked up the tower and I saw this ominous black atom bomb sitting on the top of the tower, bolted in place, winched up to the top on guide rails that I laid in. And I saw a crow sitting on it. And I said to the crow, if I were you, I'd shift. And so I went back to the control panel, gave in my personnel key, without which nothing could take place in the forward area. I was glad to see. And I was standing alongside Sir William Penny on a little rocky outcrop, which I'd shown him before when I first took him down. I was only joking. I said, it'd be a nice place to watch the bomb go off. And I was only joking, but that's where we were. And the countdown got to minus 10, 9, and I said to him, we're only 4 miles away from this. He says, oh, it'll probably be all right. And I said, I planned on being 400 miles away this morning. And so he said, we'll go together anyway. And we had our backs to it. And when it got to zero, the whole of the world that we could see lit up in the most blinding orange flash that you could ever, that you couldn't describe on such a scale. It lit up the whole sky, obliterated the sun completely, and disappeared over a 80-mile skyline in the distance, the whole of the sky. feel the heat of it on the back of our neck, turned around to see what we'd done. And Sir William and I got into an aeroplane and flew over to see what it looked like from the air. And if I had have had the advantage of reading about what atomic radiation does to people after a long period, I might not be so keen on going on that flight. I think I'm all right, I can feel. But when we flew over, all we could see was a half a mile diameter sheet of melted sand and nothing else. I said, I put the tower in the middle of that, this 100-foot steel structure, and there's nothing there. And he told me that tower turned into thin air in less than a millionth of a second. I said, you can't leave anything lying around these days. You turn your back and go. And then they said, we've got to have a permanent atomic station now to let off a series of atom bombs, a lot of bombs. Will you pick out another site closer to the Nullarbor Plain to make use of the train line across the Nullarbor? So I went on a 500-mile expedition, discovered a new site altogether, which we called Maralinga. That was the same thing all over again, the village site, the connecting roads, the weapons area and the airstrip. And then they said, we can't let the bombs off 40 miles from the railway line without knowing where the 100,000-foot air movements are going to transport the radiation. Will you pick out a weather station which would give us those results? So I said, where do you want it? And they said, they knew straight away between Adelaide and Darwin. And I thought, well... and I looked at them for a second and they looked at me quite anxiously. Do you think you could? And I said, oh, yeah, I could jam it in there easy. So... So I went 400 miles west of Alice Springs into the Rawlinson Range area, picked out a site for a weather station, which we call the Giles Weather Station, which is still in operation today as a weather station, the most remote in Australia, adding to the overall weather picture of Australia for aircraft and so on. But the initial purpose for that weather station, we called it Giles after Ernest Giles, who'd named the Rawlinson Ranges 100 years before. Nobody had been there before or since him. And so that was the station that gave the Maralinga the dates on which the bombs could be exploded with the knowledge of the other stratospheric air movements. Then they said, will you make a road out to it? We can't find it. So I had to make a road out to it. And it was on our way up the Stuart Highway with our party. I was on my way with all our equipment to build a road from the Stuart Highway near Alice Springs, South Australian border, right across through the Musgraves, Manns, Tompkinsons, Peterman Ranges and out to the Rawlinson Ranges, the very first inroad made into that country west of the Stuart Highway ever attempted. And so we got this little party of fellas I had caught. We had a bulldozer and a grader and their operators, a cook and a long-distance supply driver. And my idea was to, we'd make the road actually as we did the survey for it in the details. So I went ahead on 500-mile return expeditions, finding out where I was going to put the road, actually locate the road. And then I'd come back and guide the bulldozer with a flashing mirror off my Land Rover. And the bulldozer driver followed that flashing mirror for 8 years, never caught it. So when we had the road up to the Giles Weather Station, therefore, people could come along with trucks and semi-trailers and actually build a station because Maralinga wanted to start setting off the bombs and they wanted to know when they could. Then when I got there, they said, will you make 4,000 more miles of road now? And I said, yes, when would you like them? And they said, straight away. And I said, oh, well, that's good. And I put my watch away and I stayed out there for another 8 years. Building a network of 4,000 miles of road which would cover the whole, straddle the whole of the centre line of my original survey for the line of flight of the rockets right across to the Indian Ocean. So I continued the road I'd made to Giles, another 500 miles west through the Gibson Desert. And when I called the camp the Gun Barrel Road Construction Party because I thought I was to be the one to open up this million square miles for the first time and I'll keep it neat. So I keep straight lines wherever I could, 30 miles, 80 miles, 100 yards even, but straight lines instead of a lot of wiggles. And so when I made the first road across Central Australia, nearly 1,000 miles long across the centre, joining the east to the west for the first ever, I thought, well, I've heard of the Eyre Highway and the Stuart Highway. I'll call this the Gun Barrel Highway. And that's been registered as a place name in Australia forever now. That's the Gun Barrel Highway, officially recognised and registered. Then I made another road from near Alice Springs to Marble Bar across the Great Sandy Desert, carried on the road I'd made to the Emu Bombsite, another 800 miles to the Great Victoria Desert, made another a series of roads from the Nullarbor Plain up to cut those right up to the top of the Great Sandy Desert up near Halls Creek area. And all in all, that was 1 million square miles, and now that has been the forerunner of all sorts of settlements and Aboriginal affairs, making communities out in that country that they could never get into before. Mining companies, mineral exploration, gas exploration, seismic survey teams, all can get out of it, into that country for the first time since the world was created. And so it was quite a satisfying sort of a project. And I found a line of rocks in the desert once, put there by human hands, might have been anything up to hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And won't be long. And I described them as being an Aboriginal site, and somebody rang me up from New Zealand and said, I'd like to see these rocks. I don't think they're put there by Aborigines at all. They're put there by flying saucers. So a fellow came over, I took him out there. He sat in amongst them for 4 days, meditating to absorb vibrations from them. And he lived on nuts, which was appropriate. And And then I found a tribe of blacks 1,000 miles west of Alice Springs who had never seen a white man before. That was a terrifically significant discovery. And one day an Aboriginal woman came into my camp with a toe flapping. She dropped a rock on her second toe, and it wasn't very well put on after that. And I said, I'll be able to fix that for you. And she said... She was so sick with it, and so I radioed to the doctor at Woomera and said, what's the best thing to do for her? It was a beautiful green colour. I told her that I didn't think it was supposed to be green, but it looked nice. And so he said, cut it off altogether. And I said, well, I haven't cut off many toes. Will you stand by? And I'll tell you how it's going. So I put the mic down, and I found I was on my own. There wasn't a soul at the horizon. And so... Finally, 4 days later, I found out why she went away, because a black fella came into my camp a couple of months before with a spear through his leg, and scraping on his other leg as he walked. And I pointed it out to him. I said, you'll get a bad leg out of that. You don't know. And I was going to saw it off both sides of his leg and make it neat. And they said, no, that's a good spear. We can't waste it. So I pulled it out with greasing it with fat and put some stuff, and I radioed to the flying doctor to come and land on an airstrip I made specially for him. And he was flown away to Alice Springs to be fixed up properly. But these blacks couldn't believe that he was ever going to come back to them, and that's why she went away. They thought she was going to be sent off to the sky and they'll never see her again. Well, all that sort of thing made her frightened, and away she went. But 4 days later she did come back, very sick by this time, so I boiled up a scalpel and a pair of forceps in an autoclave, a black billy, and held the toe in the forceps, and I started to cut off this toe. And I'd so rarely cut off toes that I couldn't look at bully beef for 2 weeks. And when it came off, I didn't know what to do with it. I thought, now, I've never had a toe in a pair of forceps. The nail needs clipping anyway, and so... rolled it up in a bit of paper and gave it back to her. I said, this is yours anyway. And you put that in a glass of water tonight and the toe fairy will leave you with it. All the work I did in Central Australia, it wasn't a job of work to me. It was an absolute privilege to be allowed to do it. When you're given the whole of Central Australia to do it as you want for so long and shape the future of it, it's not a job of work. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be able to. And it's the same way as to share the stories with a group of people like you who are in your own right doing so much for Australia and Australians yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations, Lynn. Australia couldn't do without you. You've just told us that. Thank you very, very much for making your life's work such an interesting story for us. And on behalf of District 982, I'd like to make this presentation to you. It's a painted tile, a ceramic tile, and as you can see, it's an Australian.